जी माय पूरी धाम की जाय, जगन्नाथ पूरी धाम की जाय, गंग माय जमुना देवी की जाय, भक्ति देवी की जाय, तुलसी महारानी की जाय, समवेत भक्तवृंद की जाय, गौर प्रेमानंदे। All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnupadaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane. Nirvisesa Sanyavadi Paskachadi Satarani. Panchakalpa Chubhyaschaki Pasindubhyevata Patitanan Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's August 21st, 2015, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, which is Vidura's Talks with Maitreya, Text 32. Tamaso Bhuta Shukshma Dhir Itakam Lingam Atmana. Please chant. Translation in purport by Srila Prabhupada. The sky is a product of sound, and sound is the transformation of egoistic ignorance. In other words, the sky is a symbolic representation of the Supreme Lord. There's actually a very, very similar verse later on in this canto by Lord Kapiladev, which we may look at in a moment. If I can just... Yes, it's in the 26th chapter of this third canto. It's text 32, interestingly enough. This is also text 32. The translation of that one is, when egoism and ignorance is agitated by the sex energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the subtle element sound is manifested, and from sound come the ethereal sky and the sense of hearing. So going back to today's verse again. The sky is a product of sound, and sound is the transformation of egoistic ignorance. In other words, the sky is a symbolic representation of the Supreme Soul. On today's purport. In the Vedic hymns it is said, Etasmad Atmana Akasha Sambhutaha. The sky is a symbolic representation of the Supreme Soul. Those who are egoistic and passionate ignorance cannot conceive of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For them, the sky is a symbolic representation of the Supreme Soul. Tamaso Bhuta Shukshmad Bir Yata Kam Linga Atmana. The sky is a product of sound, and sound is a transformation of egoistic ignorance. In other words, the sky is a symbolic representation of the Supreme Soul. So here Srila Prabhupada says that if our ego is impassioned ignorance, we can think of God as the sky. We have a lot of verses, chapters of the Bhagavatam, sections of the Bhagavad Gita, as to how to conceive of God in the world, in the material elements, in the material objects. And Srila Prabhupada emphasizes that this kind of meditation is important for the beginner, which is why it's there. I mean, it's there in four chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, 7, 9, 10, 15. I haven't counted the number of chapters in the Bhagavatam, but there's at least three in the second canto that mention the whole universal form. And here we have this again in the third canto, here with Vidura talking to Maitreya, as we said in chapter 26, also text 32, of Kapila talking to Devahuti. This kind of meditation is very important because we're in this world. We want to become Krishna conscious, but unfortunately we're false ego conscious, we're ahankara conscious. This is the difficulty. We're very conscious of our body, Yesterday I got bitten by a red ant, and it was stinging so much, and because it was stinging so much, all my awareness went to that sting. We tend to do that, something with our body. All of our consciousness goes to the body, or we're aware of the mind, or our bodily relationships, or what we're doing in the world, and what we see and hear and smell and taste and touch. And that's what our awareness is of. That's what our consciousness is of. So how are we going to change that to Krishna consciousness? You know, when we try to just say, okay, meditate on Krishna's leelas in the spiritual world. Most people who are in ahankara consciousness, especially in rajagun, tamagun, which is the majority of the population of Kali Yuga, and we have to say the majority of the people who want to be Krishna conscious also are starting from rajagun and tamagun. Frankly, we don't get that many already Brahman realized or, you know, sattvagun people coming some. So what are we going to do? You say, okay, look, think about Krishna's pastimes. Think about Krishna stealing butter. So you can do that. You sit down and you think about Krishna stealing butter. Yesterday I was really meditating on the Shamantaka jewel pastime and meditating about Krishna fighting with Jambavan. And it was continuous fighting. Like when Bhima fought with Jarasandha, they had a break every night. But with Jambavan, I don't think there was any break, and how the residents of Dwarka, after 12 days, they gave up. They left, and Krishna was fighting and fighting. And then he's given this beautiful girl, Jambavati. And Prabhupada said, Jambavan looks like a black African. So Jambavati would also look like that. And how Krishna took her to be his wife. And I was thinking, oh, so she was the second wife after Rukmini, because Satyabhama wasn't married. So I was meditating on this for a while, but it's hard to meditate on something like this all the time. It's hard to go through one's day from the time one wakes up in the morning until the time one goes to sleep and just meditate on Krishna's pastimes and Krishna's form. It's very difficult. Even if somebody is sitting and chanting, as I think we all have experience, we sit and chant and our mind goes to something else. This is one of the biggest questions that people ask as I travel the world. You know, how can I chant attentively? How can I chant without my mind wandering? And so many people have so much advice for this, but frankly, our mind goes to where our false ego is. It goes to where our sense of self is. It goes to where our environment is. And people may think, well, you know, if I just go to Vrindavan or Mayapur and, you know, just take seminars. But even there, I mean, we find even in Vrindavan and Mayapur, people are talking politics. People are concerned with shopping and so many things. It's not that just doing that, or like Prabhupada was asked, I think it was in Hawaii, when Prabhupada was asked, is it faster if you live in a temple ashram? And Prabhupada says, that depends on whether or not his mind is on another subject matter. So this is very hard for us, and people can be chanting 16 rounds minimum, following the four Vedic principles, worshipping the deity, rising early in the morning, reading the Shastras for 10, 20 years, and still find that their focus on Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes, all total during the day, is not more than 5 or 10 minutes. I remember I was speaking to one leader, this really struck in my mind, who said, I'm very conscious of Krishna consciousness, but I'm not very conscious of Krishna. So one can be very conscious of Krishna's service, but not very conscious of Krishna. And that's not ultimately pleasing. You know, if you do lots of things for your wife, but you never think about her, she's not going to be pleased. You know, just, well, I've done all these things for you, yeah, but you don't care about me. You know? So what are we going to do? And there's many solutions. We'll look today at one of them. This is not the only solution, but it's a solution brought up throughout the Shastra. And that is that we meditate on how Krishna is in the material energy. And if one says, well, this purport doesn't apply to me because I'm not egoistic in passion and ignorance, then one can ask, am I already absorbed in the Supreme as he is? Is that my absorption? You know, am I absorbed at least every waking moment, and my dreams are about Krishna? And if that's the case, then this only applies to you in terms of guiding others. So we're going to look at two aspects of meditation on the Lord as sky, because two are brought up in this verse. Hopefully we'll have time to do both. These are topics that I present each one of them as an hour and a half seminar. So we're really just kind of skimming the surface today. And the first one is going to be how we meditate on the Lord as space. So space is the element from which all other gross states of matter and energy evolve, which is why it's in this chapter of the Bhagavatam, because this chapter is talking about creation. So first there's sound, as it even says in the Bible, which Prabhupada would quote, that the first was the word. And of course, if you ask my experience, is if I ask any audience anywhere in the world, what was that word, they were all say that that word was Om. So first was the word, first was sound, and from sound comes space. So just as space is the foundation of all material elements, so Krishna is the foundation of everything. And this is something we can think about as we look around us, all of us, wherever we are in the world. As we look around us, we are in space. And in the same way, Krishna is also there as everything. Now, of course, one of the most peculiar aspects of space is the difficulty of our mind and senses to describe, define, or perceive it. We often understand space more by what it is not than by what it is. So we usually define space as an area without furniture, a shelf without books. And in a similar way, people who rely on sense perception, they struggle to define the absolute. They end up saying, neti, neti, no, he's not this, he's not this. And even though it's very hard to define space, it's the main component of our material reality. It's the main aspect that we're dealing with in the material world. I mean, the scientists tell us that our so-called solid objects are 90% space, that the atom is made mostly of space, and even the wooden furniture in our room, the rocks outside our door, the trees, the houses, the things we think, a piece of concrete, things we think of as most solid, are really mostly space, which pervades everything. And as we can think about that, we can think about how Krishna is also everything, and he is the essence of everything. Now, also with space, how we define and understand space depends on our level of consciousness. For an example, we grow some pineapples here, and I had a couple fresh picked from the garden sitting in my kitchen waiting to be offered to Giriraj this morning. And I thought, oh, pineapples have a really thick rind and they're really prickly and I'm not going to get any bugs. And I woke up this morning and there were some bugs trying to eat the pineapple. So those bugs they don't have the same concept of space as I have. Right? They don't really understand how the rooms in this house are connected. If they're crawling on the windowsill, or I have geckos that climb on my windows all the time, when they look out the window, they don't understand that there's a road there, and they don't understand that that road leads to other roads, and et cetera, or that we're an island in the Pacific, or a planet floating in the universe. They can't understand that. I mean, even a little baby, before they can crawl, before they're mobile, when you walk from one room to another, the baby will cry. Because from the baby's perspective, you've just gone out of existence completely. You dropped off the edge of the universe to them. Once they can crawl, they don't do that anymore because they have a sense of the rooms being connected. And depending on one level of consciousness, space is perceived very, very differently. And in a similar way, depending on one's level of consciousness, depending on how developed we are in spiritual realization, depends on to what extent we can perceive God. Now, the next time you see a little bug on your windowsill, and the next time you see a little baby, well, think about this. I met an agnostic in the farmer's market the other day from Bengal. And what he doesn't understand is that God can only be perceived when one is advanced in consciousness. And when one is not advanced in consciousness, God's right in front of you, and you don't really understand him. Now, usually we don't notice space at all. We're not so aware of it. And similarly, we're not so aware of Krishna, although he's all around us. when we do notice space, it usually evokes very positive, expansive emotions. We feel relief and satisfaction. I mean, the space of a road going through flat land, where you can see the horizon is very far away. You know, the feeling of freedom one feels on a beach, where you have the wide open space of a long beach like the Gold Coast of Australia, and the ocean, and this even the relief we feel when we free up space in a drawer or in our closet or on a bookshelf, right? I helped my son clean out his closet the other day, and you know, you look at it and go, wow. And similarly, our hearts become freed from the clutter of material desires and ambition. And when we get rid of the anartas, we free up space in our consciousness for our relationship with Krishna. And when we do that, it gives us such relief and satisfaction. Whenever we let go of an anartha, it's like that. You know, immediately we feel freedom. Although we think that our anartas are our friend. Now, another thing about space is the concept of sacred space. So most of us have some area in our room or in our house as a sacred space. And in the same time, whenever we see this sacred space, we can think like that, that Krishna is always in the sacred space. And really, the sacred space is around us all the time. And space around our body, it allows us to stretch, to have health, to have movement. Right? The animal rights people talk about how terrible it is that the animals are confined with no space to move. And whenever we want to express real joy, we surround our body with space. We jump, we dance, we dive, parachute, right? And space is like joy and freedom. And it reminds us that Krishna's reality is full of freedom, joy, and play, and sports. Now, example I give a lot is that when I was living on the road without a base, without a home, which I did for about 7 years. So for the first time in my life, I noticed that people would ask the question, where are you from? Where do you live? And that it was a question that any stranger in any culture, in any part of the world, feels free to ask any other stranger. So other questions, you know, what's your name? What's your occupation? Are you married? That you have to get into a little bit of conversation first. But any stranger feels completely free to go up to any other stranger and ask, where are you from? And again, I didn't notice that until I didn't have an answer. I said, I don't live anywhere. And I wonder why that was the first question. Why do people ask that first? About a tenth of people who asked me that question were so disturbed by the fact that I didn't have an answer that they kept trying to get me to answer it in another way. They said, well, where do you stay when you're not traveling? I said, well, I'm always traveling. Well, where do you spend the most time? I said, well, it depends on what month it is. And they wouldn't accept that I didn't have a place. And I ended up really thinking about that and realizing that when we want to understand something, we have to first identify it in space. And that can remind us of the fact that things only have meaning when they're in relation to Krishna. We have a hard time assigning meaning to everything unless it has a relationship with space. And in a similar way, as Krishna says, what is illusion? That which appears to be of value, but we don't see the relationship to Krishna. So things only have value when we relate them to Krishna. Mm. Now, space also is very much connected by Krishna himself with his opulence of detachment. So Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita that the sky represents his detachment. And this is one of Krishna's six opulences. It's interesting that people in the world generally go for the other five opulences, especially if they are in passion and ignorance. People go for beauty, wealth, strength, fame, and knowledge. But all of those six opulences are much more shaky and temporary and out of our control than is the opulence of renunciation, which I find quite interesting. Like, how fast can we lose our beauty? Right? In a moment. A disease, an accident, beauty can be then that's gone. And anyone who lives long enough is going to lose their beauty. One's strength and one's health, again, that can be lost in a moment, and most people lose that as they get older. One's knowledge can be lost in a moment, a fall down the stairs, right? Again, any disease or accident, just getting older, we lose our knowledge. Our wealth can be lost in a moment, especially now that people's wealth is just numbers on a screen. I mean, I talked to one devotee who in 2008 told me that in a moment he lost half of his wealth. And what to speak of fame? Fame is the most tricky. It can also turn to infamy or be lost in a moment. Someone's famous one month and the next month they're an unknown. And all of those are very much out of our control, no matter how much one tries to amass beauty, strength, knowledge, fame, wealth. You know, somebody else can take it away. It's something that fills us with anxiety, as Krishna says about the demons bound by a network of anxieties. But renunciation is a very interesting opulence. Renunciation is internal. It doesn't depend on the type of body or possessions that you have, nor does it depend on the actions of others. And therefore, it's a material opulence, undoubtedly. Krishna is not impressed by renunciation any more than he's impressed by beauty, and renunciation will not take you back to Godhead any more than wealth or beauty will. But still, it is a higher level of material opulence. It's very much in sattva-gun, and it's something quite internal. It also gives beauty to all of the other opulences. If someone has the other opulences but are proud and attached, those opulences aren't even so attractive. People who are very proud of their beauty or proud of their knowledge and their wealth and attached to it, it's sort of revolting. And this renunciation is extremely, extremely attractive, this detachment. So it's really one of the most attractive opulences of Krishna, although sometimes the devotees complain about it. And so looking at the sky, which we talked about before, is very much associated with freedom, relief and freedom and joy. Also very much with this renunciation, with this detachment. And Krishna talks about detachment and neutrality throughout the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, also so much of the Bhagavatam is focused around this detachment and neutrality. Krishna gives this equilibrium and detachment as one of the main symptoms of bhakti, although the material opulence of neutrality does not attract Krishna and cannot give us Krishna consciousness. The neutrality and equilibrium that come as a result of bhakti make one very dear to the Lord. The verses in chapter 12, text 13 to 20, have a lot to do with equilibrium, being detached from heat and cold, honor and dishonor, fame and infamy, friends, enemies, and neutral. So it's all about being detached, of saying, I have nothing to do with this. And the sky reminds us of how Krishna is this supreme detached, particularly as the Supersoul, as Paramatma. The Lord's mood is entirely that of detachment and neutrality, which is why, of course, the devotees preach, and as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur so nicely explains, that the Lord's mercy follows the mercy of the devotees, because the Lord is neutral. There's no way that we could have any material so-called enjoyment without the neutrality of the Lord. I mean, people ask this. They say, why does God allow us to do things that are bad for us and give us bad reactions? I mean, after all, we try not to let our children do that, right? We try not to let our children touch the hot stove and run in front of a car. And when our kids become older, we try to keep them from illicit sex and intoxication and so forth. You know, we say to our teenage daughters, don't wear that kind of dress and, you know, don't hang out with those kind of people. So why doesn't Krishna do that? Why doesn't he remove from us the ability to do things that are going to bring us suffering? And the answer is very simple, that otherwise we would have no freedom. But the Lord loves us so much. How does he give us that kind of freedom? You know, with an ordinary child, it's not just the love of the parents that give them that freedom as the child grows up. The children insist upon it, and it's a legal part of our modern world. Such was not always the case. If you look at the stories in Chaitanya Charitamrita of Raghunath Das Goswami, you could see how his parents, they were able to keep him a virtual prisoner in his house. And that was an accepted part of society at that time. But at the modern society, once a person gets to be of legal adult age, the parents don't have the legal right anymore to restrict them and force them to do what's good for them and remove what's bad for them. But Krishna doesn't have any kind of restrictions of law. So how is it that Krishna can stand by and watch us do things that are going to harm us? Because he has this mood of neutrality. That mood of neutrality is necessary for the freedom of the conditioned soul. Otherwise, our freedom would have no meaning. Of course, if we're very, very sinful, because the use of our freedom in a very sinful way will severely harm others. So we may be put into the body of an animal or a plant or an insect, where our ability to harm others is very constrained. Our ability to harm ourselves are very constrained. But eventually, again, we will get the chance for freedom. You know, even in the court system, they don't put someone in jail eternally. You know, of course, this person may stay for their whole life. But the idea is that one gets another chance. And this is all due to the Lord's neutrality. So when we see the neutral sky that doesn't mix with anything, that keeps to its neutrality, so many things are happening in the sky, but the sky is not involved. And we can remember Krishna's neutrality as the super soul. Of course, Krishna also exhibits this neutrality in some of his leelas. And the leelas where Krishna exhibits his neutrality are those which bring ecstasies that appear to be negative or painful, and such as Krishna leaving Vrindavan with Akura, Krishna leaving the gopis in the Rasalila, and then even leaving Radharani in the Rasalila. Now, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he's leaving Jagannath Puri, and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is fainting, he just walks away, you know. When he's going on his tour and Gadadhar Pandit tries to follow him, and Lord Chaitanya just gets in a boat and Gadadhar Pandit faints on the shore, and Lord Chaitanya just goes away. And so this is the detachment of the Lord. And we may think again, well, this is very painful. For Krishna's leaving the gopis in Rasalila, it's got to be one of the most painful parts of the whole Bhagavatam. The gopis the sadhana siddha gopis who engaged in sadhana for, you know, waiting for millions of lifetimes in order to have Krishna, and then they finally get called by Krishna. You know, there's the Vastaharan Leela, and he says he'll meet them later, and then he finally calls them and tells them to go home, and then they stay, and they're just at the pinnacle of everything that they ever wanted. All of their desires are being fulfilled, and then gone. Just gone. Goodbye. So why does Krishna do this? The gopis themselves, they ask Krishna, why did you do this? You must be ungrateful. You must be guru druhi. You must be a very low class person. But without Krishna's opulence of independence, he would not be the all-attractive. As we said, this opulence of renunciation, it is the most attractive of all the opulences in one sense. And it adds attractiveness to all the other opulences. The sense of detachment, of not being attached. And ultimately, without this detachment, there's no meaning to love. What? Huh? I thought love is extreme attachment. Yes, but love is also on the platform of freedom. If I am loving you because I need you, then I'm not loving you. I'm loving my needs. I'm loving myself. You know, all of us want to feel needed in the sense of being valued. But we don't want to feel needed in the sense of being used. We want to feel we're important to others, but we don't really want to feel we're important to others because of the work that we do, or because we fill some kind of hole in that person's life. We want to feel valued by others just because. Just because. Because we're who we are, and they're who, and they just feel that we're important because they do. And that means there's total freedom. That means there's total freedom. Without total freedom, there's nothing, you can't have something that's called love. If I don't need you for anything at all, and yet I choose to spend my time with you, just because you add something to my already fullness, that is love. Of course, Krishna is sad indeed when we reject him, but he's sad for ourselves. He's sad to see us suffer. It's not that there's some lack on his part. So this is the inconceivableness of Krishna, that he doesn't need us and yet he values us. And we can also, space can remind us of some of Krishna's leelas in relationship to space. When the universal form, where Arjuna saw all the space of the universe in one place, Mother Yasoda looking in Krishna's mouth and seeing all of outer space. Right? Where Krishna's philosophy, where Lord Brahma says in the Brahma Samhita, Kopi Sorachaitam Jagananda Koti, Yat Chakrasti Jagananda Chayayananta, Andantarasta Paramanu Chayantarastam. How Krishna uses space is amazing. Right? How Krishna's in every atom, and inside every Krishna is the universe. So within every atom is the whole universe. How can the whole universe be within every atom? How could Mother Yasoda see herself within Krishna's mouth, not a vision, not a picture? She was in Krishna's mouth and yet seeing herself in Krishna's mouth. What does Krishna do with space? Our Lord Brahma came to see Krishna and saw that there were so many thousands, millions of Lord Brahmas all seeing Krishna at the same time. And other than our Lord Brahma, each Lord Brahma thought, oh, Krishna's only in my universe. How could Krishna appear to be only in each Brahma's universe, and yet our Lord Brahma saw all the Lord Brahmas at the same time? How does Krishna play with space? Amazing. And we have some pastimes like Krishna flying through space on his chariot with Arjuna to go see Mahavishnu. Of course, Krishna likes to fly around with Garuda through outer space. Such a playful idea of God, that he likes to stand on the back of a big eagle. That would be fun, huh? And fly around. So we've looked at how the space around us can remind us of Krishna. I'm sure we can think of many, 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 many more examples in our daily life as we interact with space. It's just a question of tuning our mind to it. And as we said in the beginning, we're already thinking about our false ego. We're already thinking about our body, our mind, our things, and then we're thinking about space. We're already thinking about space. So it's a question of thinking about space in relation to Krishna, which is a lot easier for most people than just thinking about Bhima killing Jarasandha or Krishna dancing on Kaliya. Now, the other point in this verse, which we don't have time to get into in depth, but we want to mention at least, is again this point about sound. Here it's saying the sky is a product of sound, and sound is the transformation of egoistic ignorance. And as we say, this is also in text 32 of chapter 26 of this canto, Tamasat, from egoism and ignorance. Bhagavad Virya, by the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Shabda Matram, the subtle sound element. Adbhut was manifested, Tasmat, from that, Naba ether, Strotram, the sense of hearing. And Prabhupada, in that purport, talks about that sound is the source of the whole material creation and the whole material dissolution. And sound is also the source of our particular entanglement and our particular liberation. So that's a very fascinating subject matter. How sound creates space, which then creates touch, which creates gases or air, which then creates form, which creates fire or radiant energy, which creates taste, which creates liquids or water, which creates smell, which creates earth or solids in the main creation, which is what we're talking about in this part of the Bhagavatam. And then in the secondary creation, it's explained in the 11th canto, chapter 12, text 17 and 18, how the Lord enters into the chakras of Lord Brahma as sound, as subtle sound, and moves up from the Muladhara chakra up through the Vishuddha chakra, and then comes out of the mouth of Lord Brahma as the sounds of the Vedas, which then create the material world. And when everything is wrapped up, it all goes back, it reverses. Everything reverses and goes back to sound. So, as Prabhupada explained in 3.26.32, our own material entanglement has begun from sound. The sound of, I want to be the center, I want to be the enjoyer. And that sound, just like Om created the universe, so the sound of our wanting to be the enjoyer has created the false ego, the intelligence, the mind, the body, and all of our gross and subtle activities in this world. And the way that we regain our original form, we have to reverse this process of creation in our own lives. As Srila Prabhupada explains in 4.23.16, he says, one should know the process of creation and should meditate upon the creative process inversely and thus become free from material contamination. So what we do is we engage our gross senses, our body, our speech, our mind, in vibrating spiritual sound. And when we vibrate spiritual sound, then we gradually return to our original condition. Again, that's a real synopsis. So this verse gives us a lot of ways of meditating on Krishna in the world and gives us the hint here about that one of the main processes for reviving our original consciousness so that we see Krishna everywhere is in this sound. And in this way, Krishna consciousness becomes much easier. One could say it's still not easy because we're very attached to the ahankara. So even meditating on Krishna as space and Krishna in space, space is Krishna, even that may be difficult because we just want to go about our business of satisfying our senses. But it's certainly a little easier for the conditioned soul. And once one starts to understand the material elements in relationship to Krishna, it's factually much easier to segue to meditating on Krishna's lilas and meditating on Krishna's personal form. The fact that that's easier is very much indicated in the order of the Bhagavatam. How it starts out, of course, in the first canto with a lot about Krishna's pastimes. And then, poof, there we are in the material creation and the material elements and the universal form. And then we start getting back into lila, and that this mixture of meditating on Krishna in the world and meditating on Krishna's eternal pastimes is there throughout the shastras as something quite important. So we need to do it. It's a question of making a deliberate, conscious attempt to do it, to say, okay, I'm surrounded by earth, water, fire, air, ether. How do these enhance my meditation on Krishna? How can some quality or aspect of the material elements which surround me spark my remembrance of Krishna? You know, for the residents of Vrindavan, Krishna's form and beauty and flute and etc. act as udipans or stimulus for the remembrance of Krishna. But frankly, when they come to this world, so do the things in this world. There was that devotee Mukunda who, as soon as he saw a peacock fan, he fainted in ecstasy. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he saw a sand dune, oh, there's Govardhan. He sees the ocean. Oh, there's the Jamuna. So one can become like this. That is ultimately Krishna consciousness. So questions, comments?
Lovely class, as always. Thank you. In the early part of the class, you were mentioning, and I'm going to have to paraphrase because I don't remember exactly what you said, but you were quoting a devotee that said something to the effect that I'm conscious, I'm not so conscious of Krishna, but I'm very conscious of my service. Aren't we taught to not make that strong of a distinction between Krishna, service to Krishna, Krishna's devotees, Krishna's paraphernalia, etc., etc.? I had heard one time Prabhupada said, Bhagavatam in the morning, bank balance in the afternoon. So if we're thinking of our service, maybe we're repairing an automobile and we're thinking about the fuel pump and where to go to get that fuel pump, and we're installing it, and where's the vice grips and where's the wrench. Isn't that also a meditation upon Krishna?
Let's see if I can find this. Everyone should think that he's engaged in a particular type of occupation by Rishikesh, the master of the senses, 1847 purport, and by the result of the work in which he's engaged, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, should be worshipped. If one thinks always in this way, in full Krishna consciousness, then by the grace of the Lord, he becomes fully aware of everything. I mean, what Prabhupada would say is that as you think, I'm doing this for Krishna, naturally you'll think of Krishna. Let's think about a material example. You know, why do so many people at work have a photograph of a family member? Because they want to remember, I'm working for this person. I'm not really working, you know, you go meet with your banker and they have a picture of the wife, the husband, whatever, the children on their desk. Because they want to remember, I'm not really working for the bank. I'm working for my family. And that needs to be there with us. If we become absorbed in the work such that we forget for whom we are working, then that's not really sadhana bhakti. Because sadhana bhakti, Rupa Goswami describes as shilanam, activity. But those activities, Jiva Goswami, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explain, that's an activity both of the body and of the mind. And sadhana bhakti, vaidhi sadhana bhakti, we're talking about beginning. Second chapter, Nectar Devotion. Vaidhi sadhana bhakti begins with thinking about Krishna. So the purpose of the work that we're doing, and I don't have the verse right at my fingertips, the purpose of the work that we're doing is to get us to think of Krishna. I mean, let's be very frank. Is anything we do in this world externally, does it really have any importance or meaning in and of itself? We're just playing with sandcastles here. You know, the in and of itself, whatever we do in this world, it's a dream, this world. What does it matter what you do in a dream? I mean, just really, frankly, nobody's really doing anything here. Krishna says in 5th and 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we're not even acting here, we're just witnessing, we're not the doers, it's just the modes of material nature moving around, and you know, we're accomplishing things in a dream, or a computer game, or in sandcastles, whatever analogy you want to use, and in and of itself, the work we do here really doesn't mean anything, nor is Krishna particularly interested. You know, it's like if your child makes you food out of clay. You know, those of you who have children, so you know that the children are playing with clay and they make a cake out of clay. They make a cake and they make rice and they make all these things, and they bring you the clay food and they say, "Here, mommy, have this clay food," you know, and you pretend to eat it and they're happy. Yeah, but does the clay food have any meaning? It doesn't have any. What's meaningful is the exchange of love, and what's meaningful is the relationship that's being developed. That's what's meaningful. My daughter-in-law's father, Gopavindapal, who likes to tell the story of one of his sons when he was 6 years old, or maybe younger, brought him a stick and said, "Oh, Daddy, here, look at this stick." And Gopavinda Prabhu said at that moment he understood, what does it mean that we're offering things in this world to Krishna? We're working hard for Krishna in this world. It's just to develop that relationship. So if I get absorbed in my work and forget the relationship, it's not bhakti anymore. You know, then it's work for Krishna, which Krishna explains also eventually that will bring you to the perfect stage, but that's not the point. So why do we need to work for Krishna? In that letter, Prabhupada says, it's so we have a means of practically applying the philosophy. The purpose of the building the temples and the... It's so we have a way to put the philosophy into action. Also, we're doing all that to bring other people to Krishna and bring them into the relationship. But that's the purpose. The purpose of the temples and the Bikarinams and the festivals and the cooking and all this is just to get everybody else to fall in love with Krishna. Not to have some number, you know, I've distributed 1 million books and you've distributed only 1,000 books. And that's... So if we forget the who we're doing it for, and we forget the... and just become absorbed in the thing. Would we want that in our human relationships? You know, if your wife's cooking for you, certainly you want her to be absorbed in the cooking. But you want her to be cooking for you. Otherwise, you might as well just hire a cook. You know, the hired cook and the wife, they can both cook excellent meals. Maybe your hired cook can cook a better meal than your wife, I don't know. But the point is the love. The point is the relationship. And you're thinking when you're cooking, what do my family like to eat? That's what I think about when I'm cooking, right? Cooking for, what do they like? You're thinking of the people. When I went to Puerto Rico. So I got there, and the next day, literally the next day, they put me in the kitchen. I think I got there on a Thursday or Friday. And that Sunday, they had me cooking the Sunday feast. You know, it's unfamiliar kitchen. And, you know, Puerto Rico's part of America, but it's got a very different culture than most of America. Most of the signs are up in Spanish and so forth. And unbeknownst to me, the main food in Puerto Rico is rice. And I just got there. I didn't know. And for the Sunday feast, I made rice, but there was this breeze all the time, and it kept knocking out the flame under the rice. And you cook a big quantity of rice with the flame going out all the time, it doesn't cook very well. So it didn't turn out very good. And the devotees were so upset with me. And they said, you know, you can't have a Sunday feast without good rice. It's the most important food here. And they said, and it was just totally plain. So the next week I made Jamuna's eggplant curried rice. One of the fanciest dishes I know how to make. Takes like 4 hours just to make the rice. And I cooked it on the candy stove where the flame wouldn't go out. And then they told me, oh, the people in Puerto Rico, they don't like such heavy Indian spices. Yeah. So then I had to really meditate on what do they like. And finally I came up with just rice cooked in whey instead of water with some shredded carrots and a little nutmeg. And everybody was very happy. And my point is, when I was cooking, I had to meditate on what they liked. When I was cooking without meditating on the people and what they liked, it wasn't very pleasing. Even I made that fancy eggplant curried rice, which is, it's a good rice. And wow, you make it right, it's a big thing. I was working so hard. But I wasn't really meditating on the people. And therefore wasn't pleasing. We're doing everything for Krishna. We should be meditating when you're ordering the new carburetor and you're figuring out the paint for the room. And, you know, I'm doing this for you, Krishna. I'm doing this for you, Krishna. May you be pleased. May you be pleased. That's the point. And, you know, you can say, well, that's hard. Sometimes the things that we're doing require all of our mental attention. You know, there's all this research that we can't really multitask, that we just move from one thing to another. Or I was just reading the other day that if people are playing music in the car, they turn it down or turn it off as soon as they park. Since they're parking, because parking requires so much more mental concentration. At the same time, when we're in love with somebody, we do think about them all the time. We think about them even when we're parking. We think about them even when things require our utmost mental concentration. When a boy and girl are in love with each other, when a family, parents have a brand new baby, they're just thinking about that loved person constantly. Even throughout everything else, it's entirely possible.
Thank you. That's a beautiful answer.
Thank you for asking the question. Anybody else?
Brother Rimmel, I just have a comment. I usually follow along with my Srimad Bhagavatam, and it translates Tamasaha as from the mode of passion. And also, so the translation is the sky is a product of sound, and the sound is a transformation of egoistic passion.
I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at the Bhagavatam in front of me. Maybe you have an older edition, and it wasn't corrected.
Okay, yeah, I do have an older edition, yes.
Because tamaha almost always means ignorance. Raja is passion.
Okay.
So just the normal understanding of tama is ignorance. And you see that in today's verse and also the other verse I referred to from the 26th chapter. It's again tamasat, which is also egoism and ignorance. So anyway, it would be very strange to see a tama being translated as passion. It was most likely a mistake. Anybody else?
Yes, I have a question. Several weeks ago, you gave a class that was actually similar. The verse, it had to do, if you remember, about the Lord, his heart was like the sky.
Oh, yes.
And you... Okay. Now, in one devotee was pointing out to me that in many... Here, I'm sorry. Mute somebody just one second. In several places, like for instance, it pointed out in the songs of the Goswamis, in different poems, it'll refer to the sky of the heart in relationship to the devotee. Any comments what that means? Because they were kind of just asking, you know, what does that mean? And
I'm really not sure. The heart is often referred to in Sanskrit as a cave, which would be quite the opposite of the sky, a very secret, confined place rather than an open place. So I really don't know. I mean, a reasonable assumption is that the sky is again this openness and this freedom. And that, as I was talking about today, real love is only possible in absolute freedom. The more freedom that you have, the more detachment that you have, the more you can have something that's real love. When you're attached and you're confined, then what you have is selfishness. And this is even our experience in this world, that love and freedom has to go together. I tell this story sometimes. I was visiting, I was staying at a devotee's house many years ago, and the husband and wife got into an argument. And which is interesting. Generally, when there's a guest over, husbands and wives try to avoid getting into arguments. So anyway, they got into an argument while I was there. And the wife wanted her husband to do something, and he just basically refused to do it. So she stormed out of the house, furious. And after she left, you know, so she just left him and the kids and me there. And I talked to him and I said, you know, how do you feel about this? And after some thought, he said, well, I become afraid that if I do what my wife wants me to do when she's in that kind of a mood, you know, just, you have to do this. He said, if I do it, I'll lose my freedom. But if I don't do it, I'll lose my relationship. And he said, I get stuck between these two fears of losing my freedom and losing my relationship. And it just hit me. With Krishna, we have both, complete freedom and complete relationship. We don't have one at the cost of another. And that's exactly what we want. We don't want a relationship where the attachment, if there's some sort of selfish attachment and we've lost our freedom. We want love to be entirely a manifestation of our free will. And this is, it's something that's quite important to us. you know, it's important to us. I want to do things because I want to do them, not because I feel obligated to do them. I don't want to do things because I feel I'm being forced. I have to. Nor do we want people to be with us out of force or obligation. We'll say to people, you know, are you doing this because you want to, or are you doing this because you feel that you have to? It's even a problem, a very common problem in relationships, is that a person doesn't want to, this particularly women get like this, a person doesn't want to tell the other person what they want. You know, a person doesn't want to say, well, I like, you know, a new pair of blue shoes from this company for my birthday. Because they think if they ask specifically for what they want, then the other person is acting more out of obligation. Whereas if they don't ask, the other person is acting more out of freedom. Which, again, that's a little silly. But the idea that love and freedom go together is real. So to say one's heart is like the sky, and the sky is the ultimate symbolic representation of freedom, total openness, certainly makes some sense in that context. Anybody else? We could take one or two more. Thank you very much. Shrila Prabhupada ki jai.